Hi everyone, and welcome to episode 14 of the Well and Well podcast. So today we have an entrepreneur on who is doing amazing things in the world of gut health. Her name is Nikki Peters, and she is the founder of The Culture Collective, a company who specializes in producing incredible fermented foods like kimchi and sauerkraut. And if you don't know what these kinds of foods are and how they can help your body, Nikki goes into this in more detail on the episode, but basically they contain live bacteria, which when you eat them can help diversify the bacteria in your gut, which is super important for your overall health. And Nikki explains that the science out there is showing that a microbiome in the gut that has diversified bacteria is much better than one that has a high concentration of certain type, if that makes sense. So Nikki goes into a bit more detail on that. She started her career in the mining industry as a geologist and stumbled upon her love of fermented foods and all things gut health when she found her lifestyle in her corporate job was making her feel really shit and unhealthy, basically. So long story short, she ended up creating the Culture Collective. And I was so impressed when speaking to her because her first retailer that she ever landed happened to be Whole Foods, which is just amazing. And I love the story that she explains around that in the episode. So I think it's a great episode, especially for anyone thinking about starting a product-based business or anyone who wants to learn more about gut health. Also, if any of you came to my event in July, you would have received some of the Culture Collective's kimchi or sauerkraut because Nikki very kindly supported us and partnered with us on the event, and we put some jars of her products in the goodie bags. So if you tried that, they're absolutely delicious. I love them. But yeah, you'll get to hear more about her story on this episode. So thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy. And if you do enjoy, I would love it if you could share this episode with one friend so that we can grow the reach of this together. I'd really, really appreciate it. Thanks for listening. Welcome, Nikki. Thank you so much for coming on my podcast today. It would be great if you could start by doing a little bit of an introduction for the listeners.
Thank you very much for having me, Susie. It's I'm really flattered, actually. I'm still really flattered that people actually want to talk. Oh. I am the owner and founder of a business called The Cultured Collective, and we are specialist producers of a range of unpasteurized, naturally fermented kimchis and sauerkrauts. So we're all about making delicious products from natural, high quality ingredients.
Mm-hmm. And they're delicious, by the way, might I add. Thank you very much. I love the spicy kimchi, it's so good.
Thank you, that's so kind.
It's really interesting having you on because you came from a corporate background as well before starting up your business. So that's definitely something I kind of want to start with. And I was reading back through my notes of when we had our first initial chat on the phone, and I think we should start with kind of your uni choice and start there, because I think we both kind of agreed on the phone that that's like one of the biggest decisions that you can make, and it feels so long ago, but it really does shape the path for like 10 years after, and you don't kind of realize it at the time. So I actually picked up on something I wrote down where I that you chose the best uni possible, but it wasn't necessarily what you actually wanted to do. And I was reflecting on that, and it's such an important point because we grow up with pressure from our parents, teachers, society to pick the best options for our future. But when does that end? And for me, like, that started with picking my uni, my grad job, moving to a different job because it would look good on my CV. And it's like, we're always trying to ensure this future for ourselves. And it's kind of like, if we don't like what we're doing, then that's going to negatively impact our future anyway. So what's the point of choosing that? So yeah. I would love to kind of, on that kind of basis, chat a little bit around your thought process for the uni that you chose and the course that you studied and what you think about that, basically?
I think at school, I was never given the option, and I think I never ever considered not going to university.
Yeah.
It was just the path. You go to school and then you go to university, and that's a given. And another given was you try and get into the best university possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when I was younger, and maybe most people feel the same, success to me, or being a successful adult meant, was going to be measured by how much money you were making, mm-hmm. And how many people you ended up managing. And of course, to be the most successful, you have to go to the best university you possibly can.
Obviously.
That's just the rules. I took that as fact, not as some, you know, that was fact to me. So actually, because I was quite academic at school, I was one of my school's Oxbridge candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And my choice of course was more dictated by what I could get into Oxford for, or what I could apply to Oxford for.
Right.
The admissions criteria, I guess, is slightly stricter than other universities.
Mm-hmm.
So I know I ended up originally applying to do geography at Oxford, and everything was going well. I got accepted to do my interviews. And then that's sort of where where the wheels fell off, I suppose, because I did not perform well. And I eventually got rejected for that place. So then I found myself in the position where I wasn't in my first choice university. And I was then going to be looking to read a subject which I wasn't entirely sold on. Mm. So I remember this being quite a stressful time, because back then, I think, you know, I would have only been about 17 and experiencing probably my first major failure, I guess, as well. And then also at that stage, you feel like the decision that you make on your university and your subject dictates your career and the rest of your life.
Yeah. But it's on that point, though, like, it's not, I know we're laughing about it, but we were 17 at the time, and though, and it, like, teachers and everything, they make you feel that that is the be all and end all. It's not really necessarily our fault, I don't think. I feel like it really is presented to you as in it is so, so important for you to go to the best one possible. So how are you going to challenge that from people that are, you know, older and wiser than you?
No, I completely agree. And I don't have, you know, I don't have a different take on it. I don't have a different answer. I felt like I had massively failed in being rejected from that place. And I really felt like I had, you know, this was my first big stumbling block, and I wasn't already at 17. I thought, oh my gosh, I'm not going to achieve.
Oh my gosh, just because you didn't get into Oxford, it's crazy, isn't
it? Yeah, the future that I want.
Yeah.
So I just remember being really stressed at this stage. But I think what eventually happened was I spoke to my friends, spoke to my parents, and lots of sort of frantic last minute phone calls later, I ended up settling on geology at Bristol. So that's what I ended up doing. Again, I didn't have a set plan. It wasn't like I suddenly decided I wanted to be a geologist, but I liked the university. I liked the look of the course, and I managed to make peace with that. Although I wasn't over the moon, and it certainly wasn't plan A, I made peace with it.
Mm-hmm. See, that's quite a lot for a 17-year-old to deal with. And I think it's such, like, I know it's young, but it is really, it's probably one of the first big decisions that we make that's really, really influenced by external factors, and probably the first time where we make a decision that could really impact 5 or 10 years down the line, but we're not really old enough to kind of challenge perspectives that are coming at us and the pressure coming at us, if that makes sense. So that's why I wanted to chat about that, basically. But then from that point then, so you ended up with a geology degree at Bristol, which is an amazing uni anyway, so that's great. And you ultimately ended up in the mining industry in Western Australia. And given I have family in Western Australia, I know how kind of remote and random that is to end up there. But it's just hilarious that we kind of have this link. But tell the listeners a little bit about how that happened.
It was never in my plan, really. I didn't know where my degree was going to lead me. But I guess we were quite lucky because it must have been in my third year, we had some recruiters from Australia come round and I guess just give our class, you know, a chat about this is what's on offer for you in Australia, this is what you could be doing, this is what you could be earning. And well, I was sold. It just looked amazing. So from then on, I was like, right, that's it. As soon as I'm done, I'm on a plane and I'm going to go to Australia. Mm-hmm. Things didn't quite pan out like that because I actually graduated in 2009. So back then, the mining industry actually crashed and everything went quiet for quite a while. So that was another sort of spanner in the works for me. But I did still go to Australia. So I went, I was just on a tourist visa and I worked in bars for a little while and I traveled around.
Was that in WA or East Coast?
That was on the East Coast.
Okay.
So I guess it's actually the standard backpacker route, or it was back then, you go up the coast. Then come 2010, the industry had started to pick up again. My friend and I had gone all the way up the East Coast and I had no money. So I guess, you know, I looking back, I was so young, I was only 21, but I thought, God, okay, I've got my degree. I guess I should go and get a job now.
Next thing we have to do to do life properly.
yeah exactly, that's it. I was like, well, I've had my fun now, I've had my few months traveling, I guess I should grow up. So I think it was contacts through a friend of a friend of a friend, who I think, like a lot of first jobs are when you've got no experience, because that's also really hard to get into. And yeah, I think it was maybe April 2010, I was working as part of the exploration team for a gold mining company.
Mm-hmm. Nice. And so can you explain a little bit like what that practically means? Like, what are you actually doing? Because I hear the mining industry and I know like WA, there's a lot of that going on there, but I don't actually know what goes into it. And my view of mining is like someone going underground and like looking with a little hat and a light on. And I'm pretty sure you aren't doing that. So what you're actually doing.
I mean, that does happen. Okay. But so I was working in exploration. So my job was essentially finding the next mine for the company that I was working for. And practically how our jobs worked, I guess, or how the lifestyle was, is most people were based in Perth, so they live in Perth, and then you would work shifts. So you would fly out to your mine site, because as you say, WA is huge and remote.
Yeah.
You'd take a plane to your site and you would live on a camp and you would work a shift. And those shifts would be, my shifts were anything from 8 days to, I think the longest one I did was about 20 days. Mm-hmm. But more often than not, it was 8 days. So I would work 8 days and you work 12 hours a day, stay in camp, and then at the end of your shift, you fly home and have a week off in Perth.
Mm, okay. And what are you doing? Like, how do you find a new mine? Are you sat at a computer? Like, how do you do that? What are you doing every day?
All sorts of things, actually. So essentially, it's field work. So you're collecting data. So somebody has identified a target that they want to go and have a look at. And normally you would design a program. So it would be a drilling program to go and test the target. So right. You go out to the field, collect lots of data, and then you'd come back, plug it into a computer and sort of assess, is there something there, is there not?
Right.
And then if there is, then you take it further.
Okay, makes sense. And so how long did you do this job for?
quite a while in the end, I think maybe okay. about five or 6 years.
Okay.
I did make the conscious decision, though. I actually work for a consultancy company, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't stay in a set role or with a set company. I would move around quite a lot. And that was a decision I made because my idea was that I would consult for maybe, you know, 2 or 3 years, get good experience with small companies, large companies, work in different sort of geological functions. So I'd really have a good idea of what was on offer, what sort of roles there were. And I was hoping to find something yeah. that felt like a good fit for me and something I could see myself settling into and I guess progressing my career.
Mm-hmm. So what was the reality then in terms of how, I mean, as corporate jobs go, that's quite different to most people's experience. But what did you like about it and what did you not like about it? And I know at this point, it might be worth chatting a little bit about the career progression that was on like offer to you. And I know that was like back in Perth, which adds an interesting element to it as well. So what did you genuinely think about it at the time?
It's easy to say looking back on it, but I really enjoyed the job. I really did. But the hardest aspect of it was the lifestyle factor.
Mm.
So I think, as I said, because you're flying to work constantly, when you're field-based, you can't really build any sort of life for yourself in Perth.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you're on-site, you are sort of wishing your shift away, you know, yeah. so you can get back on your break. But in terms of the actual jobs, I most preferred that field work. And that field work, because of the lifestyle factor, is normally for junior staff.
Mm.
As you progress and as you get more senior, I suppose, with a lot of sort of field work, you spend less and less time in the field and more time in an office. And I'd come to learn that I hated the time spent in the office.
Yeah.
The best fit for me was a bit of both. So it just seemed very strange to me that I was going to put myself in a situation where I was working very hard and aiming to get myself into an office-based role,
yeah.
which I had already identified that I didn't really enjoy. So I sort of found myself in this headspace, and I guess that's maybe where a little bit of discontent or doubts about my path or what I had always assumed my path would be. That's where they sort of came about.
Mm. Yeah, okay. I totally get that. And I think, yeah, it's such a contrast in terms of the type of job and almost the lifestyle as well when you look at what was the career progression. So let's take it a little bit more on the angle of the lifestyle and how you found that your health was kind of taking a bit of a knock and your overall well-being and how you felt about that. And I know you did something about it at that point, so it might be good to chat a little bit about that.
Oh yeah, definitely. Site-based work is just not good for you. I'd say it's not good for it's not good for most people. Some people can really make it work, but I couldn't. And it might be because I was young and I was new to the industry, and also maybe the consulting factor, moving around quite a lot. But it was important for me, or I felt back then, to be sociable at work. And socializing, essentially, when you're at camp, involves, you know, just sitting around and drinking. So I found myself doing that most evenings, which obviously when you work a 2-week shift, you know, if you're sat around drinking every single evening for 2 weeks, it's not the best. Also, you're working a 12-hour day and the work is quite physically hard. So it's just quite exhausting and you don't get good sleep, or at least I didn't. And the camp factor as well, you're not able to prepare your own food, so you're eating cafeteria style, I suppose.
Right, yeah, okay. How did you, like, what was the options? Because there's not going to be a lot of shops out there.
No, I mean, it varies obviously from site to site. Some sites you'd be where there is a small town. Right. Some sites were completely remote, so you would have whatever you were given. There might be one option.
I've been to some of those small towns in WA, but there's literally like I don't know how many shops there are there, to be quite honest.
No, I know. Yeah, so it's not
tiny little IGA.
that's it, that's exactly it. So all of these things obviously took their toll. Drinking, just eating badly, not sleeping very well. And the last thing you want to do after not much sleep and working 12 hours is, you know, if there is a gym, you don't want to go to it. And
yeah,
too exhausted to go for a run or anything like that. So I think maybe it was like 6 months or a year of that. And I was just feeling not good, just really not good. Not good in myself. And, you know, I still must have only been 23, 24. So I was in my early 20s. I was living in Australia. I should have felt great.
Yeah.
And I just didn't. I didn't feel confident in myself. I felt like I looked bad. So I did decide, I guess, maybe a couple of years in, to do something about it. I was like, right, I'm going to overhaul my lifestyle. And I think originally that probably was some silly yo-yo diet. But it was at this time that clean eating first came about.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it gets a bad rap now, but in the beginning, it was just such a simple message of just be more aware of what you're eating, take an interest in what you're eating, cook your own food, eat unprocessed food, and put a focus on quality nutrition. And I think it just resonated, the whole message of that resonated with me much, much more. So I got fully on board with that, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it is a bit of a cliche, but it, you know, a few months later, I was transformed.
Yeah.
I looked different, but I think, you know, what really sold me on the message, or hooked me, I suppose, was I just could not get over how much better I felt.
Right.
I just felt so much better in myself. Not just my body, but my mind, my digestion, you know, my skin, everything was just so much better. And all I had really changed was, you know, my diet.
Yeah.
So I think from then, that's where my interest really started. Because, you know, I really thought, well, you know, there's something in this. There's something in this. And I wanted to learn more. So I that's where my podcast obsession started.
Yay.
Yeah, I know. I was quite early on to it back then. Because I used to spend so much time, like, you know, in remote areas as well, like quite a lot of time alone during the day, I would just have tons of things downloaded that I could listen to. So, yeah, I learned so much more about holistic health. And a lot of actually the people that were talking about these things were Australians and Americans. And it was just this idea that, you know, the body is an interconnected thing, and what you eat does have an impact on how you feel.
Yeah.
And that's what I had experienced. And central, obviously, to this idea of holistic health is gut health. Mm. And the idea that, you know, your digestive health is really a... well, it's a central pillar to your overall well-being. So that's actually how I first learned about fermented foods. I heard somebody talking about them on a podcast, and I thought, I must try them. And so I booked myself onto a workshop in Perth where I learned to make some ferments.
Oh.
And it was, well, from then on, it was a complete obsession. When I look back to it now, it was, for me, I think ferments are just, it's the marriage of everything that I love. So I've always been a massive foodie, and there's something about the artistry that's involved in the food prep and balancing all the flavors. But fermentation as well is also a lot about science. So it's like each batch you make.
Can you explain what a ferment is, just for the listeners? Because I think some of them won't know.
So when I say ferment, I just mean a fermented product. So yeah.
What is that process? What does it mean?
Essentially, so a ferment is when bacteria has transformed a product. So right. If I use sauerkraut as an example. Mm-hmm. To make a super simple sauerkraut, you would shred some cabbage, salt it, and pack it in its own brine. So you're essentially making an environment where the good bacteria that live on the cabbage will multiply, and they will produce acids that preserve that cabbage and transform its flavor. So you end up with sauerkraut in a few weeks' time.
Mm. And can you explain a little bit about what you learnt about good bacteria? Because, again, people hear this term, but they don't necessarily know what it means or like why it's good and bad, if that makes sense.
Yeah, sure. So this really is sort of, I think, at the cutting edge in terms of like nutritional science.
Yeah.
But it's generally accepted that having diverse colonies of bacteria that live in your digestive system is a marker for good health.
Mm.
So that is something that's now generally accepted. So in sauerkraut, for example, there is good bacteria that has preserved that product. And when it's unpasteurized, that good bacteria is still alive. So in theory, you can eat that, and you're helping to introduce these bacteria to your digestive system.
Mm-hmm.
And more studies are showing really interesting links between the types of bacteria living in your gut and your mental health, hormonal health, and all sorts of things like that. So I think it's, you know, I'm very much interested to see where the science goes. And I think it's a very interesting area of research.
Yeah, definitely. It's really fascinating, I think. Okay, so then you went to this workshop, learned how to make them. And I guess, at what point did this start to become a bit of a seed in your mind around a potential business idea?
Funnily enough, not for some time.
Okay.
Not for some time. Because as well as listening to health nutrition podcasts, I started to listen to a lot of things about business, personal development, and things like that. And I, as I previously said, it was sort of around this time as well that I was realizing that maybe geology wasn't going to be for me. And I thought, maybe I will start my own business. But everything I was listening to was very much focused on finding your passion. Find your passion. Find what makes your heart sing and what you love doing. Yes, what you love doing all the time. And I would sit there thinking, God, I don't have a passion.
What is my passion? Like that as well. I don't like anything.
Yeah, I was just thinking, oh my gosh, because, and I think it's the language. When you hear the word passion,
yeah,
you just think, you know, fireworks. I must be feeling amazing whenever I'm doing this thing. And I just could not. I could not, for the life of me, identify that thing. And it was, and I wish I could remember who said it now, but again, it was on a podcast. And I think it was this one woman said, your passion is the thing that you make time for every single day.
Yeah.
And that is what really resonated for me. And then things started to click into place.
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, that was very much nutrition. I was very much into what I was eating, food preparation, and fermentation. I was, you know, I was packing my suitcase to go to work full of all my little ferments every week.
I love that.
I was completely obsessed, but because it was part of my daily routine and my rituals and habits, it was so normal to me that I never for once considered it to be my passion, because it was just a part of me. It was my normal everyday life. How could that be my passion? But ultimately it was, you know, it seems counterintuitive, but it was important to me. I do it every day. It's my passion.
That really triggers me, actually, because I was the same. I worked with a business coach for a bit of time a few years ago, and she was like, it was quite a low point for me. And she was like, Susie, what are you passionate about? And I really tried to think of something. I really tried, and just nothing came out. And I was so depressed by that. How the hell can I not be passionate about anything? It's so awful. And then we did a bit of work, and I realized that actually my thing is sport. I just love sport. I always played it growing up. And again, like what you've said, it just never occurred to me that that was a passion, because that was just part of my identity and part of me. And I just love sport. I just like playing it. Like, I never thought I have a passion for it. Like, because you just don't think of that. You're looking at like new things that you like or something like that for some reason. So that really does trigger me. Definitely resonate with that one.
That was honestly the single biggest turning point for me, because this side of my life, you know, I was, I guess, obsessed with this side of my life, and I loved it, and I was doing it every day, but I never once considered that that should be the direction I take, I suppose. I think sometimes, and I see it in a lot of my friends now as well, there is this feeling of confusion over passion, because I think a lot of us do feel passionless, when really it's just about, you just got to identify what, maybe a better word to use would be priorities, because you manage to, what you prioritize, you manage to do and get done every day. So maybe that would be more helpful language than passion. I'm not sure.
Like, what do you incorporate into your life just every day without even thinking of it, because that's important to you, I guess.
Exactly. Without even thinking, you will make the time to do that.
Yeah. Such an interesting point, definitely. Okay, so you identified that your passion.
Yes.
And then you were listening to more sort of commercial, businessy related podcasts. When did those two things come together?
So by pure chance, actually. So I was living in Australia, but I'm English, obviously. So I traveled back to England for a friend's wedding. And I could not, for the life of me, find fermented products anywhere. And obviously I was on holiday, so it's not like I could just quickly prepare a sauerkraut or something. So it was very easy to identify a gap in the market. There was a gap. It was very obvious. Mm. The products aren't in England at the moment. I think the thing that was maybe a little bit more difficult was there a market? You know, is there a commercial side to this business? And that was the thing that back then, well, the answer was no. Because the conversation surrounding gut health, fermented foods, it wasn't in England at that time. And I'd say this was maybe 2015. And I thank Australia for this, because Australia is quite forward thinking in terms of health food trends, I guess, health trends. And I was able to see that things that were trending in Australia or had become mainstream were coming to the UK just a few years later. So examples I think I used at the time were things like almond milk and, you know, natural peanut butter. It seems crazy that there was a time when we lived without almond milk, you know, but there was a time. And I think that gave me the confidence that the trends would follow on in England. And I very much had this sense of it's now or never.
Yeah.
Because the gap was there. I guess the only leap of faith I made that eventually the market would be there as well. And I just had this sense of it's my chance, and now I've got to do it. So that's when I guess the idea of having the ferments business really then came to the forefront of my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't obviously act upon it straight away. I was still living in Australia at the time. Mm-hmm. So I went back to Australia, but I think at that time I did make a plan to leave. Mm-hmm. So I think this was maybe August 2015, and I solidified a plan in my mind that I would be heading back to England to start my own business in 2016.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Love that. Okay, so I get that about spotting the timing. I think you're definitely right, like the timing was good as well. And I suppose I also understand how if the conversation wasn't happening, the demand isn't there yet. So, but you could spot the trend coming over from Australia. You could see little things starting to happen in England. So I totally get that. Okay, so you decided then that this is something you were going to do. You were going to leave Australia, quit your job. What happened next, and how did you start to take action on building the business?
I think so. The move from Australia was a very definite decision by me to say this is a full stop on my career as a geologist.
Mm.
So that was a definite decision. And my decision to come back to the UK then was I'm going to start this business and it's going to be my main focus. Ultimately, I still had to be sensible. Living in London is incredibly expensive.
Yeah.
And starting a business is incredibly expensive. So I was lucky enough to have some savings. I had been saving in my job in Australia, as I think is a good idea for anyone to do. If you've got the opportunity, just put some money away. You know, in the future you might have a mortgage payment, or in my case, I had some cash to help me start my business and get me set up in London. But there was no way I could do it without finding a job. So I was looking for roles that were maybe part-time hours or just something that would be less stressful, so I could devote more energy to starting my business, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a long and slow process is all I will say, like looking back on it, especially with a products-based business. I pretty much spent the whole of 2016 experimenting, so developing recipes. And it was a really, really fun time. It was probably, you know, one of the best times. Mm. I was experimenting with ingredients, developing my products, my launch lines, and as well, you know, developing the brand. That's when the name, The Cultured Collective, arose.
It's such a good name.
The branding, but also trying to think, what did I want this business to be about? But that whole process took, you know, nearly a year. I only sold my first jar of kimchi and sauerkraut at a farmer's market at the end of 2016.
Oh, how did that feel, by the way? I felt selling your first physical product must be amazing.
It felt absolutely amazing. Yeah. I was so incredibly nervous as well. Oh. I was sharing a stall with a really good friend of mine. And I remember the feeling of selling my first jar and, you know, poking her and be like, that's the first ever jar that I've sold.
I love that.
But it was brilliant. And obviously for me, you know, doing the farmers markets was introducing people to my products, but also getting feedback. That's such a huge, huge part of, you know, having a food business. You need people's feedback. You need to see how the products are received. So it was a really fun time, but it was a hard time as well. You know, I was working during the week. I was making and packing product in the evenings, and then I was working at the farmers market on a Saturday. Mm-hmm. So it was tough, but ultimately I knew it was a stepping stone on the goal and that I had decided on, really. So
And I think that's really interesting, your experience of getting a job, starting the business on the side really early stage, and then putting it out there and getting feedback. I think it's a really good combination. And I'm picking up on this theme of a lot of people that I've had on this podcast so far, where they will get a part-time job when they've got the idea at the very early stage. And they're all saying it's about picking a part-time job that reduces the amount of energy that you're spending on it. So it's getting rid of the snobbery of, oh, I need this like job that I'm qualified for. No, it doesn't matter. Just pick something that's gonna give you the money, that doesn't take too much of your energy or your time, that keeps it ticking over, because you want to preserve the energy for all of your business stuff. So it's really interesting to hear that that's kind of what you chose and adopted as well. It definitely seems like a theme that people are talking about.
Yeah, exactly. 100%. That was a very conscious decision, because although I could have got, you know, a more technical role and I thought, okay, that will give me a lot more money, maybe I'll be more comfortable, there is no way that I could have devoted the time and energy into starting the business and getting it off the ground if that's where my headspace was. It just absolutely was not an option. So yeah, you are right, actually. There's an element of, I don't really want to do that sort of job, but and it's silly. It's really silly, because it is what I needed to do at that time. And it was the best thing. It allowed me the headspace and effort to put into my own business.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. And then, so if we fast forward a little bit, so you sold your first jar. So the next bit I've got down from my notes, which seems like a massive jump, but getting your first retailer. So how did you build up to that, and how did that happen?
So I think the important point here is I'll be completely honest, I really had no idea what I was doing in terms of business, food industry, anything. And if that is the situation that you find yourself in, the best thing that you can do, and it's what I did, is seek out community. Mm-hmm. So seek out peers, and also mentors. So people, I really put effort into seeking out people who are in the same position as me, just to share experience and for moral support, and also mentors, so people who were already selling, essentially, so already had stockists. So I got some idea of how to go about scaling a small production, and I could envisage myself setting up a small kitchen, and I thought physically, okay, I can make this work. And then once I figured that out, I thought, okay, so now I'm going to go and try and find a retailer. And again, community, I would say look to socials, because for food businesses in London, there is lots going on socials. And I spotted an event that had a pitching competition as part of it. And it was a bit of a stretch, because I remember the ticket was quite expensive, but I thought, oh God, okay, look, I've just got to do this, because it will be a one-off cost, and then I can pitch to a number of people and get feedback on my product. So as part of the application, I then had to quickly set up a website and all sorts of things like this. But I did actually, I won a place to pitch, and the pitch was to Whole Foods.
Amazing.
So I went to this event. I was incredibly nervous, obviously, but I pitched the products to Whole Foods.
It's almost like the god of the health food world, isn't it? What a one to start with.
When I was starting the business, it was, you know, I dreamt to have my products in Whole Foods. So this was a very, very big moment for me. And again, I wasn't sure how it was going to be received, because there were no ferments around.
Yeah.
But Whole Foods love the product, they love the brand, and they said that they wanted to list me the following year. So
incredible.
That was at the end of 2016. So I had the ball rolling essentially for having stockists set up for 2017.
Amazing. What was that like? How did they tell you? Did they call you up? Like, how did they?
No,
did you get the news?
And I think, again, I was just incredibly lucky with my timing, because at this stage, I just didn't have much competition. Mm. And Whole Foods obviously have buyers that are very aware of the food trends, and they knew what they were looking for. I am not a salesman in any way, shape or form. It was an enjoyable pitch. And I don't think I've said, you know, had the opportunity to say that much. I really enjoyed the pitch, because I think they wanted the products. So it went smoothly.
Mm, definitely. And so at what point did they tell you that they wanted you to stock it in the shops there and then? Oh, amazing.
It literally happened in the pitch.
Amazing.
So she said we'd like to stock the products and get the ball rolling, essentially. I walked outside the building and I did cry. I think it was it was like relief tears. Because it was the end of 2016, so it had been quite a long year by then.
Yeah.
And also the fact that it was Whole Foods, I thought, well, they know this product is going to be trending. And it almost felt like, okay, you've made the right decision. The gamble might be paying off. So that was really lovely. That was really lovely.
That's amazing. And I know we're kind of coming up to time, but I just think, I just love that story, and I love that you landed them as your first one. It's just so great. I love that. So before we go on to the quick fire round, it would be great if you could give the listeners, if there's any listeners out there who have an idea for a product-based business, what is your advice to them? If it's just an idea in their head, like, what is the one step or two steps they can take to just start putting the feelers out there or researching the market? What would you say is the first step that they could take?
Definitely, as you said, put the feelers out there. I would, if you can, just have a browse on social media. Look for maybe not somebody that's got a directly competitive product to yours, but somebody who's in a similar sort of space. And just send some DMs out, just send some messages out, because, you know, I'm still amazing friends with people that I DM'd years ago when our businesses were teeny tiny babies. And, you know, we're all still great friends and still a massive sense of support. And when I need advice, I still go to these people. So people do want to help you, I think, generally.
Yeah.
So if you can get that advice from somebody that's done what you want to do firsthand, do it. Definitely do it.
Yeah.
But also, the next thing I would say is there's never going to be a perfect time to start your business or launch your product. If you are short of time or short of money, you don't have to do one of these great big launches with a huge PR budget. As I said, I started selling at a farmer's market and, you know, passing my products around friends. You can get feedback and do some market research yourself on a limited budget. So I would say definitely seek out community, seek out somebody that's been there, done it before, and just do it. Just start on whatever scale you can manage. Just start, because that's the best thing you can do.
Yeah, amazing advice. Okay, Nikki, we've got a quick fire round that I ask everybody. It's just three short questions.
Okay.
If you're ready. So first one, what's the best book that you've ever read?
The Alchemist.
Ooh, okay. And why would you say that?
Gosh, why would I say that? It's just so profound. And for somebody, probably a lot of the people that will be listening to your podcast, we're all, you know, goals-based. What's the next thing? What can I be doing? What will make my life better? Where do I need to be? The Alchemist is just such a brilliant book about the journey. And I won't say any more than that.
Okay. Nice. Okay. Second question. So the name of this podcast is the Well and Wild podcast, because I believe that to be well in life, you need to do some wild things and dare to go against the norm sometimes. So sure. What's the wildest thing you've ever done?
The wildest thing? I mean, we've just been talking about it for 45 minutes.
This is my problem with this question. Everybody that comes on here,
I know. I'm not an adrenaline junkie. That's the thing. I'm not like I want to fling myself out of the plane or anything like that. But you know, the things that my friends find terrifying, I seem to just want to do. Whether that's quit my job, start my own business, move to the other side of the world. Like those are the things that I do, which I, again, seem to see as normal things, but everyone else thinks they're pretty wild.
Yeah, I think that is such a good answer. And I really believe that's because you have this entrepreneurial spirit. Like, I think if people are destined to be entrepreneurs, they just have this thing in them that they just want to constantly challenge and rebel and push. And I love that kind of spirit, if you like.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's normal to me, this. I couldn't do it like any other way.
It would be boring. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. And then finally, what's the best piece of advice that you've ever received?
Oh, gosh. Definitely to not worry about things that you can't change.
Mm.
I'm a natural worrier, I'd say. I plan for the worst and things like that. But there are some things that you will not be able to change, and just don't let them stress you out, essentially.
Yeah, that's such a good point. And I recently have taken this, because when you start a business, you do have to put yourself out there a lot, and it is scary. And recently I apply this logic to when I'm scared about doing something and I'm reluctant, I apply this logic, Susie, look at this scale. What's the best thing that could happen in this situation? Okay, that's what you want. What's the worst thing that could happen? And you just need to like rationalize the worst thing, and it's never as bad.
That's exactly what I do. I try and think of the outcomes. What can I affect change on? If I can't, then, you know,
So, and then in a way, sometimes if the worst case scenario, I'll just play that out in my mind in case that was going to happen. And then it's like, okay, that's what I do if that happens. I'm prepared, you know.
Exactly. As long as you're prepared, then that's fine.
Yeah, I totally agree. Okay, and where can the listeners find you and the Culture Collective? And where can they go out and buy your products as well? Where are they stocked? Obviously Whole Foods.
Obviously Whole Foods, yes. So you can find us online at theculturedcollective.co.uk. So that's got a little bit more about me, about the brand, about all of our products. And there's lots of nice recipes and things on there as well. You can buy our products online at ocado.com and also in selected Planet stores, Whole Foods stores, and other independent retailers around London.
They've got them in the Planet Organic down the road in Wandsworth from me, so that's
lovely.
But I also just want to touch on this as well, because some of your products will be quite new to the listeners and they've never used them before. So what kind of dishes do you put kimchi in? I mean, I put them in salads and stuff like that. What kind of
I get this question so much, but honestly, you can put them with anything. So okay. Think of kimchi and sauerkraut like a condiment. So if anything needs a little bit of extra flavor, add some kimchi, add some sauerkraut. Kimchi will add like a nice, spicy, fragrant, pickly flavor, and sauerkraut, you know, a really nice tang. My favorite way to have kimchi is with cheese on toast. It's like spicy.
Wow, I love delicious. That combo. and then also, I know it's a really important point. If anyone is to buy them, they must put them in the fridge, right?
Yes, they must. So that's why everyone's talking about them again, because live products are full of living, good bacteria. So you need to keep them in the fridge. And it's not because they'll go bad. It's just at higher temperatures, the bacteria get a lot more energy and
multiply.
Exactly. So you're going to
invade your home.
some fizzy exploding, well, they call it champagne kimchi, which you don't want if you're wearing white clothes.
Oh, that's hilarious. Okay, Nikki, thank you so much for coming on. And also, Nikki supported my event that I did back in July. So we put some of your kimchi and sauerkraut in the goodie bags that our attendees took away. So thank you so much for supporting us on that as well.
Oh, I'm no
the conversation.
Absolutely love supporting your events.
Thanks so much, Nikki.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. As I mentioned at the start, I would be very grateful if you could share it with one friend if you enjoyed it. And I hope you have a good week.